Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. This is the Cuckoo's Nest Broadcasting System presenting the Jerry Roach Show. And good morning, Tokyo. Well, today we have as our guest Joe Escalante. I can't really say, I guess, of the Vandals, but he's a Renaissance man, does everything. And thanks to Joey, the Cuckoo's Nest is famous. There's band the Vandals going around the world singing about those punks at the Cuckoo's Nest, as well as Pat Brown. I remember that night well. I call it the straw that broke the back.
that was the tipping point?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. That's when the city decided to make their move.
That was enough. Well, thanks to Jan and Steve-O from the Vandals for writing that song. And, or, depending on who you believe, Steve Gonzalez or Bob Emery. There's a lot of people that say they
wrote... Emery.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that say they wrote that song. But when I got in the band, it was a few months after the Vandals started, and I'd seen the Vandals play a couple times at a party and at the Cuckoo's Nest, and I said, I want to be in that band. I like that song, Pat Brown. I like the song, Urban Struggle. There was a couple other songs. And we got in, and they scrapped the whole list. And they said, we're scrapping the whole set, and we're going to play new kinds of songs. We're going to...
New direction.
Take a new direction. That's what they call that. Yeah. And Jan was kind of into the Gang of Four and a different direction than punk rock. Like, it was like post-punk, maybe you would call it. And then I said, well, I'm in the wrong band. Goodbye. And then I don't know what happened, but we decided, it was a compromise. I said, let's take Pat Brown and Urban Struggle. We'll keep those. And Wannabe Manor, and we'll get rid of the rest. And that's what we did.
Well, thank you for that, because like you said, I remember you telling me you're in Italy, and they're coming up to you and go, what is the Cuckoo's Nest? And
yeah, what is the Cuckoo's around. Nest? Yeah, everywhere, all over the world. And then we go, and then so we played, over the years, no matter what, we would throw in, that's not even honest to say. There were years when we didn't play any of these old songs because
you didn't want to be old, right?
No, it was a new crowd, and the old guys would come and they want to hear Pat Brown, and then when you play it, they beat up the other people the younger people.
To show
the and the younger people were the people that were keeping it going, buying the shirts and buying the records. So we just stopped playing them for a few years, and then over time. Now it doesn't matter what you play, because it's older. It's people with their grandkids at your show. You got little kids that are wearing a Vandals patch. They don't even know what it means. You got their dad that was totally into it, and then you got the grandpa that maybe.
It's all three generations now. Amazing.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but at a certain point, you really care about who your audience is, because you have to have the right kind of people to get the good shows and to get a good record deal and all that kind of stuff. But if you do the work over time, you can pretty much do what you want. And we're in that phase now where we do what we want. We all have other projects. Josh is playing with the Replacements this week. Warren, our guitar player, is working on Aquabats episodes. He's a writer and a composer. Quackenbush, our singer, got a big booze business. If the Cuckoo's Nest was open today, you'd be getting your booze from David Quackenbush.
Oh, good for him.
And he's got a cash and carry business. I've got a couple radio shows and the Kung Fu Records and a Morrissey Smith's tribute band that takes a fair amount of time. And then we play whenever the phone rings, and it's interesting. We still have the same agent we've had for years, Stormy Shepherd.
Have you been to Japan?
Many times to Japan. That's really what we do. If the phone rings and it's Japan, then we all go. If it's Australia, earlier this year we went to Australia with Metallica and Linkin Park and Slayer and The Offspring and Blink-182. And of course we say yes to that. And we'll be playing at this, Rob Zombie American Nightmare thing in October, some Halloween maze event in Pomona at the fairgrounds. So if the phone rings and it's good, sounds good, the money's there, everybody's available, we go.
But you don't have to go.
We don't have to go. Yeah. Also, we don't have new records out. You know, if you don't have new records out, you play when you want, of course. But in 2014, we will release two records. We have an EP already done that will come out after, well, in 2014. And then we're working on a full album. And I don't know what'll happen after that. Will we go on the Warped Tour for 40 dates? No. Europe for 3 weeks or 6 weeks or 7 weeks? No. But we'll do it a little bit. We'll hit the spots.
You've been traveling a lot lately. I've been following you on Facebook. So, what was Iceland like?
Well, Iceland. I went to school there in graduate school.
You did?
Yes.
I've been to Reykjavik.
Reykjavik?
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite cities. I studied all the sagas and old Icelandic, modern Icelandic in college at UCLA in the old Norse department. And then grad school, that's where you go and study the original manuscripts and all that stuff.
Huh.
And then the Vandals played there in 89, our first tour of Europe.
Did you meet Bjork?
Well, Bjork was actually, when we played there, she was in the slam pit. And I just look down, I look over, you know, at Quackenbush, and I'm like, look in the slam pit. Bjork, just, you know, because she's a little nuts. So
yeah.
She went, they said it was the first slam pit in Iceland, and she wanted to be in it. She was in it. And Siggy, the other guy from Sugar Cubes, was there. I got her pictures taken with him. A couple years later, I end up interviewing her for a Request video here in Orange County.
She remembered?
And she didn't remember.
No. Well, speaking of the first slam, you know, the Cuckoo's Nest pretty much owns that now. The first slam put, I guess I pretty much own that. No one disputes it.
Yeah, that was where the pits were started.
And I remember trying to stop it.
Right.
And
that's
the normal thing,
first thing to do, stop it. But then, you know.
Well, I think I was really thinking about it, and I remember, you know, Jim Trash slopping around on the floor like worming, and we threw him out. And but it was a big scene, you know. Like, he's the only guy, and the bouncers grab him, throw him out. So, you know. So the next week they come out and they start pushing each other around. There were about seven or eight of them. Mm-hmm. And so we threw them all out for that too. And then the next week is, I know they must have went back to school and said, hey, we all do it.
Yeah.
They can't. And then all of a sudden, it's too much. You couldn't throw the whole place out.
Right.
So we tried to contain it in that kind of a pit thing because of the high walls on two sides.
Right. You had the walls and you had a couple bouncers. So you could just kind of.
And the other, on the open
moving
end.
Moving around.
Had, just keep them in there. I remember one night the Adolescents were playing and Tony goes, oh, something always happens when we do this song, and they go into Amoeba, and the whole place went like a fire, a gas fire. Just, woof.
Yeah,
everybody, the whole place was.
Yeah, it has its own. It's like an amoeba with its own just structure and organizational chaos.
Yeah, it was. You know, it was obviously new to me, new to everyone, but it was like, oh, let's have fun. But if somebody from the outside came in, they didn't get to have any fun. You know, drunk would wander in and go, hey, this looks like fun.
Boy, yeah, yeah.
They'd work them pretty good.
It was frightening, but it was fun. But it wasn't as dangerous to me anyway. I guess maybe because I...
It looked worse than it.
Yeah, and I had the security of being from Orange County and having enough friends. But if you just went a little bit north to the Fleetwood and Redondo Beach, it was the same scene, music... violence, but you could die up there, it seemed like.
I wonder how it spread up there. Yeah, that was a scary place, the Fleetwood.
Yeah, it was scary.
Big,
I mean, people.
Cavernous.
People shaving their heads and saying, you know, I turned punk this morning. I shaved my head. And that's a scary person because you don't know where, you know, if you see someone like Jim Trash, that guy didn't have a shaved head, he had style. He had clothes that had been worn and like specific buttons that he had to collect or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And he worked on it. Yeah.
Yeah, and then that guy was a character and you could appreciate him and you know you'd see him again and you'd seen him before. Or someone like Worm or even Pat Brown, he made his own clothes where he put a lot of zippers in his clothes and he had style. And he'd been around and he had battle-worn clothing or Mike Ness. You could fight Mike Ness.
Losing the ear.
I didn't fight Mike Ness, but you could fight Mike Ness, and you knew what you were getting into because you'd seen him around. But then all of a sudden, these guys just shaved their head, and they were like, you know, football jocks or something. And they said, I'm punk today because I shaved my head. And they would even say, maybe they're punker than me because my head was not shaved, and it was like a crop on top. And I first ran into that at the Fleetwood. Bands of youths with shaved heads claiming to be punk that I'd never seen before, and they were scary. And that's when a lot of the punks scene started, you know, getting out of it. And some of those like the Hollywood people, I'd say the Hollywood people said, "I'm out of this," and they started going to art shows and things like that.
What was it? X said there, or somebody said, maybe John Doe, that punk rock ended when TSOL became a band.
Yeah, and you could, and it was maybe not
their kind of punk rock.
Sort of after that, for their kind of punk rock, but
which is more arty kind of.
Their kind of punk rock was a little too arty for us, and we wanted this. We wanted this level of chaos, but then there was another level that kind of drove us not out of the scene, but at least to the back of the room and not into the pit. I mean, at a certain point, it's like, are we going to play some music?
Yeah. What was that song you said that you still played when you get only were allowed to keep three? What was the third one?
Wannabe Manor.
Want to play that?
Yeah, that's a you know, like there was Wannabe Manor, Urban Struggle, and
Pat Brown.
Pat Brown and HB Hotel. HB Hotel, I thought it was like a bastardization of Heartbreak Hotel. And then I wrote Anarchy Burger, and then Pirate's Life, I wrote the lyrics to, based on a song that when Jan was going to redo the whole set and go a different direction. Pirate's Life, picture the song Pirate's Life, about, maybe we should play Pirate's Life, we'll play Wannabe Manor later.
Okay.
Picture the song Pirate's Life, it's about, I don't know what it is, like 200 beats a minute or something. Picture it to be, 50 beats a minute. And that's what it was. And it was a really slow jam with the flanger, and it was like psychedelic, and it's going to be like Gang of Four. And I just said, that's great, but I don't want to be in this. And I didn't have any leverage. I was nobody. I just came in as a drummer. But I didn't want to be in the band if that's what they were going to do. So when the compromise was made, I said, give me that Pirate's Life song. I'm going to take it home. I'm going to bring it back as a punk rock song. So all he did is speed it up three times and write some lyrics about taking LSD and going to Disneyland, which was forbidden to me in the
That was a great place to go.
It's forbidden,
especially at night.
You did that maybe, Jerry, but I thought that was forbidden.
If you're gonna take LSD. We swam across to Tom Sawyer's Island.
Are you kidding me?
No, we were drunk and stuff. And
just with alcohol, based on alcohol.
Yeah.
And you jumped in, what direction did you jump in? From the island back to the land?
From the land to the island.
From the land to the island, and you got there, and what happened when you got there?
We turned around and went back.
And then what happened when you got
nothing.
There?
Nothing, we didn't get caught.
You didn't get caught.
Uh-uh.
Amazing. See, these are the days when frontier land really was a frontier. I'm impressed by that.
We didn't want to try where all those alligators were, though.
I'm impressed by that. When we come back, after we play the song, I'll tell you a similar story, TSOL at Disneyland. What happens when they go to Disneyland? We'll play Pirate's Life.
Pirate's Life, written by Joey, played by the Vandals.
On the sea, but it's not the life for me. All those air detection pilots all chasing after me. we're back.
Okay.
So tell, what was your story of TSOL?
Well, TSOL was, it was Jack, and I forget which other members of the band, but a couple of Long Beach guys, and Todd was one of them, Jack and Todd. It usually be Jack and Todd would be up to the local chaos in Long Beach, and Ron and Mike were maybe...
HB.
Maybe, yeah, maybe Huntington Beach, up to, you know, their own stuff over here. And because we are broadcasting from Orange County right now, I might point that out. But the Jack and Todd and a couple guys decide they're going to sneak into Disneyland. Because no matter what you do, all that would happen at the TSOL rehearsal place on Scrivener in Long Beach would just wake up and figure out what to do, start drinking. Todd got money from his grandparents. He lived with his grandparents. They just gave him money. And he just figure out what to do that day. It was like a almost a summer camp mentality. What are we going to do today? Well, are we going to go steal range balls and hit them onto the 605 freeway? Are we going to sneak into the drive-in movie theater by taking carpets from the carpeteria swatch pile and their trash can and place them over the spikes and drive in the back? You know, all these things, nothing was going to be... There was nope. always some criminal element to everything. And so they're going to go to Disneyland. And I wasn't around this day, thank goodness. And they go to Disneyland, and they go, well, of course we're going to sneak in. So they go around, and they find a place around the wall near the 5 freeway over there. Looks the coast looks clear. They climb over the fence, and they get in, and they're in, and they're safe. They start walking around. It's dead.
It's closed.
Those are the days when Disneyland used to close on Mondays.
And sometimes Tuesdays.
Yeah,
Sunday, too.
Mondays and Tuesdays. And they would do all their painting and all that stuff then. And so there they are.
How do you get out?
Yeah, how do you get out? And they got rounded up, thrown in the goofy jail, and blacklisted for however long you can blacklist people like that. And stupid. I would have never done that. I was too afraid of... I was afraid of abusing my Disneyland privileges because it was so important to me.
Well, let's play Wannabe Manor. We got to play a song once in a while, keep them.
Yeah, Wannabe Manor was written before I got in the band, and it was about a place in Huntington Beach, a punk flop house, kind of like Kids of the Black Hole or Skinhead Manor in Hollywood. I mean, that's where we used to go. Which, as soon as I turned 16, got a driver's license, I would drive to Hollywood several nights a week, and you'd meet this people, and they had a place called Skinhead Manor. And then, so there was the complement to that in Orange County, the Wannabe Manor.
Here it is. Wannabe Manor by the Vandals without Joy.
No, I played the drums.
Oh,
on
you
this.
Played it.
I played drums on it.
Oh,
but
right.
I did not compose it.
I see. On the floor, spotted a hole. That was Wannabe Manor by the Vandals. What else do you want to play, Joey, while we're got to pause?
Like something like pause. My Girlfriend's Dead is the...
Oh, well, I was going to mention that. It's so fucking funny.
Yeah, that's
excuse
a, that's
my
a, that's
language. A... Yeah. I don't know. I was right with that all the way. I don't want to talk about it, so I say she's dead. Whose idea was that?
Yeah, that's Warren. That's an example of over time, Warren took over most of the songwriting. I went to law school. In law school, they put stuff in your brain that doesn't allow you to write music anymore. And it's very hard. I went from writing all kinds of songs to maybe contributing, you know, 1 to 2.5 per album. And then Warren was really stepped up. Dave Quackenbush, when he writes a song, he writes a great song. And then Josh Fries wrote a lot of good songs. So My Girlfriend's Dead is a good example of a classic Warren Fitzgerald song. And also the production on this, you'll notice, you know, this from the other songs we've been playing, worlds apart. This is like now we're spending, you know, $80,000 on a record when we were spending $8,000. And
makes a big difference.
Mixed by Jerry Finn, famous mixer, did a lot of Morrissey stuff and the Green Day. So, you know, it's a different world. Punk rock's making money, and we're signed to Nitro Records at the time. The first record was on Epitaph when Epitaph didn't have any money. This one is on Nitro, owned by Dexter Holland. And, you know, money's flowing. He's paying us to quit our jobs and tour around. And we're now all of a sudden we're playing on the Warped Tour. When I talked about kids that come to our shows and get beat up by the guy who wants to hear Pat Brown, I mean, this is the world we're in now. We're touring full time. This is our jobs. Somehow this ended up, the Vandals ended up to be a job. And we're touring Europe 3 times a year. We're doing the Warped Tour every other year. We're playing Japan every other year, Australia every other year. It was pretty fun. Tour buses. All of a sudden we're in tour buses.
Living the rock and roll life.
Yeah. I mean, that's like an era from 1994.
It gets old quick, right? I mean...
No, it doesn't. 1994 to 2006. That's like the heyday when the Vandals made the most money and played in front of the most people and had the most shows and did the most work. And it's not the early era. It's not the era of now. It's that 1994 to 2006. And My Girlfriend's Dead is the peak of that period from a record called Hitler Bad, Vandals Good. So let's play that.
Okay. My Girlfriend's Dead.
Yeah.
All right, let's hear it.
Someone always asks about her, so I tell them all she said.
That was My Girlfriend's Dead on the Hitler Bad, Vandals Good album. Yeah. Some more of the humor of the Vandals. Irreverent.
I have a story about the title of that I'll throw out there. Just
okay,
to,
let's hear it.
When we wanted to name the record Hitler Bad, Vandals Good, it came down to a fight between band members, and it was kind of me versus the singer. I really wanted to call it that, and the singer said, no, Quackenbush. He's just very attuned to the connection between punk rock and skinheads, Nazi skinheads, and we never want to be identified with them. But the reality is a lot of them liked our band over the years, and they came to our shows, and there's nothing you can do about it. So, but you don't want to purposely just identify yourselves with them, even if you're saying Hitler bad. To him, it was just too much. You just don't want Hitler associated with your band if you're a punk band that is trying to keep Nazis away from your shows. So we agreed not to. And then we agreed, okay, fine, you win. And we had some really stupid generic name that we used for the album. And the promo material went out with this dumb name that I won't even mention because it's so dumb. But then we were on a plane to Australia with all these bands for the Warped Tour Australia. And we told Blink-182 the name of our new album, and they said that's not very good. And of course we knew that, and they go, well, we wanted to call it this, but you know, Quackenbush says no. And they laughed so hard, and they said they were going to do it, they were going to use it. They go, we're going to use it, thank you, good, we'll use it. And so, you know, at that point we can't let them use it,
right?
So yeah, we used it.
It must be a good idea. They think it's a good idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, they, you know, we were like, hey man, they already stole all our jokes and half our music, we can't let them steal our best title we came up with. No, they're friends of ours. They're good guys.
And you've had some big bands do some covers. What are some of those? See, I know Gwen Stefani did something, right?
Yeah, Gwen Stefani. Let me finish up with the Hitler thing, because there's one big punchline at the end. Everywhere around the world, no one had a problem with it. Even Germany stocked the shelves with the Hitler Bad, Vandals Good. They didn't care. But when it came time to license the record to Japan, and Japan is to manufacture new copies, they said, we're not going to manufacture copies with that on it. It's a little more sensitive to them, the history with Hitler, they didn't want to bring it up. So they said, you got to pick a new name. And the Vandals, we don't have like artistic integrity issues. We thought that was kind of funny. And we said, fine, we'll give you a list of 10 names. And why don't you choose them, you Japanese geniuses? And we gave them 10 names. And they were most of the 10 runners up that we had all been batting around. But we threw one joke name in there. And that was Ice Cream Treat Inside. And we just thought, we just throw that in. That was never going to be a title. We threw it in there. And just to round out the list. And of course, that's the one they picked. So if you buy a Japanese import of Hitler Bad, Vandals Good, same artwork, just says Ice Cream Treat Inside. Well, how did No Doubt end up covering one of our songs? We have a Christmas album. They needed a Christmas song to do this charity Christmas album called Very Special Christmas. And they got to write an original one, but they're on tour. They're, you know, doing their thing. They didn't have time. So they asked us if they could just record one of ours from our Christmas album, and they listened to it, and because it was a lot of the reason, it was one of the only songs on the album that didn't have cuss words on it, because I had written it and I don't write cuss words. So I've written a few over the years, but maybe like two or three cuss words have made it into my songs for effect, dramatic effect. But this Away to the World, it was a pleasant, positive tale about a Indian punk and a racist skinhead punk coming together and having a Christmas miracle and everybody be happy. and so that's the one they picked. So luckily it was fortunately it was the one that I wrote. So there it went. And it was the most successful mainstream thing we've ever done. And Warren Fitzgerald produced it for him. And it was, they made a video for it in Bangladesh or some Indian place like that. And every year it gets played and all these Christmas things. They re-released it the last couple of years with a track from Eric Clapton and U2 and then this song. And pretty good. So that's been pretty good for us.
Somebody contacted me. They wanted to use part of Urban Struggle for a movie they were making about bullies. And evidently it's kind of like the same thing where this skinhead beats up a guy, and then later they meet and become friends, and I don't know.
So the skinhead's a big sellout.
Something, I don't know, yeah. But the, you know, it's about a
movie. Sellout skinheads, they don't keep to their convictions.
Yeah, it's a movie about bullying, and so I let him use the
the clip.
yeah, 30 seconds or something. I'm sure it's going to be, look at all these bastards. These awful
now, when
people.
You say you used, they, you, you licensed them a clip, it was from your movie and not our song, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it was just, you know, I don't even know what they were using, but it wasn't anything to do with that. It was like slam footage, you know.
And, you want to play another song?
Yeah, let's play, what were we on? Oh, should we do the Oi to the World?
Yeah, let's play Oi to the World. This is the Vandals version.
The Vandals
not
version,
as good
of
as
course.
The No Doubt version.
But the original.
Yes.
Here it is. Oi to the World.
If God came down on Christmas Day, what would he think? What would he say? Would he notice all we've done? Or just the bowel seldom one? I think I know what God would say if he came down on Christmas Day. He'd say to every boy and girl, where's the oi I gave to the world?
Hodgie was a punk just like any other boy, and he never had no troubles till he started up his oi band. Safe in the garage, singing in the tub, but Hodgie went too far and he plugged in at the pub. It was a cold Christmas Eve when Trevor and the Skins popped in for a pint and then lick a bag of crisps. Trevor liked the music, but not the unity. He unwound Hodgie's turban and he knocked him to his knees. The God came down on Christmas Day, I know exactly what he'd say. He'd say, oi to the punks and oi to the Skins, but oi to the world and everybody wins. Hodgie was a bloody mess, he ran out through the crowd. He said, we'll meet again, we are bloody dead and bowed. Trevor called his bluff and told him where to meet Christmas Day on the roof down at 20 Oxford Street. If God came down on Christmas Day, I know exactly what he'd say. He'd say, oi to the punks and oi to the Skins, but oi to the world and everybody wins. The guy on Indiana Jones. Police started wailing, a bloody dying man. Hodgie was alone and abandoned by his band. Trevor was still fading and still so full of hate when the Skins left him there and went down the fire escape. Hodgie saw the North Star shining more than ever, so he made a tourniquet from his turret saving Trevor. They repelled on the roof for the rest of the turban and went back to the pub where they fought each other coming. God came down on Christmas Day, I know exactly what he'd say. He'd say, oi to the punks and oi to the Skins, but oi to the world and everybody wins. If God came down on Christmas Day, I know exactly what he'd say. He'd say, oi to the punks and oi to the Skins, but oi to the world and everybody wins.
Oi to the world, yep. We're back. You know, Joey, you've done so many things, it's hard to pick out what we want to highlight, but you got your own radio show, your own, you know, record company, your band, and...
Kung Fu Records. A little shout out for my company.
And, oh yeah, we want to talk about Variety, your fight with Variety.
Okay, yeah, that was... There's many lessons to be learned there.
That's pretty good stuff. I saw that cartoon you did. I loved it.
Yeah, we the cartoons saved us in that lawsuit. So, briefly... Because it's like a 10-year long lawsuit. In 2004, we release a record called Hollywood Potato Chip, and it's a kind of a salute to the materialism, or an indictment, basically, an indictment of the casting couch. Mm. It's the theme of the album, Hollywood. To show the Hollywood. The imagery we used was the Daily Variety logo, which is they call it the Bible of the entertainment industry.
Hmm.
We took their logo, Daily Variety, and wrote The Vandals and made it look, make The Vandals look like Daily Variety. We thought it was very clever and perfectly legal. It's a parody of something, and our artists have the right to parody trademarks and copyrights. We just have an absolute right. And someone at Variety said, this is awesome. We knew an artist there. And he said, hey, the guys in the art department around Variety think this is great. They thought you did a really good job. So we sent them a bunch of T-shirts and hats and albums and things. And then someone there, the head of their marketing department, said, well, they can't do this. Talked to the lawyers, and the lawyer sued us. And it was really, really bad, and we had to take all. There was no way to win. I mean, we even if we won, we would have lost. We would have needed hundreds of thousands of dollars to fight these guys. So we took the records off the shelves, ruined the release, ruined the record label, because we had put so much money into the launch of this thing. Then it ruined the tour, because we had no records to sell on the tour. And then we kind of, you know, and that was the last thing we ever recorded. And then 8 years later, we recovered from it. You know, if you call, like, okay, I guess, you know, we play shows every once in a while, recovery. It was really bad for us. And then 8 years later, we signed a settlement with them and said, okay, we're not going to use this anymore. 8 years later, the internet is a different place.
Oh, sure.
And they start seeing images on the internet. And where do they see them? People uploading songs on YouTube. And they'll take the whole album and they'll upload a song. And we don't like that, but we don't tell them to take it down. And then they put the album cover up there. Well, we changed the album cover, but the album was out for a while. So kids buy the original album, they put up the image, and then Daily Variety comes and sues us again for this, and they don't understand the internet. And we had to deal with that. And this time I didn't listen to the lawyers, because I think I could have won the first time if I would have fought them in the way that I fight. So this time I didn't hire lawyers. I got myself admitted to the federal bar, and I fought them in federal court. I went to Delaware and fought them, because they sued us in Delaware just to make it more difficult. And I beat them there, had it transferred out to LA. And on the eve before trial, they gave up. So that was a win for us, because if we got to trial, all we were trying to get was a verdict to leave us alone, and we got it on the eve of the trial. So we were able to beat them, and it probably cost them over $1 million to fight us over that. It was ridiculous. And even more devastating this time, because there was really nothing to pick apart when they sued us the second time. And there was like vultures picking apart nothing. And it makes band members start fighting with each other when you have these lawsuits that are that serious. And you know, everyone's like, hey, it wasn't my idea to do this. Hey, I can't lose my house. You know, all this kind of weird stuff was going on. Again, we got through it. We beat them. The way we beat them was by destroying them on the internet and destroying them. We just told the truth about what they were doing to as many people as we could. And we had a contest where we asked people to make these cartoons.
Really? That's how you got it?
Yeah, using a robot graphic arts kind of system where you just type in the script and pick which characters you want to say the words and what the set's going to be like and what they're going to wear and what their voice is going to be like. And you make a little mini movie. So we had a little mini film festival. We called it the Vandals versus the Daily Variety Film Festival. And if you entered it with a movie of 1 minute or longer, you got a T-shirt and a certificate. And you know, enough people made them to where it was spreading around and it showing up on search engines. And they were finally realizing they were doing more damage by suing us, which a child of five could have told them that at the beginning. And it took them way too long to figure it out. And they dropped it again on the eve of the trial, and I thought I was going to have to go to trial against these guys, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
A lot of pressure.
Oh, it was awful. It was terrible. I had to go on Zoloft. Yeah. I mean, I know you're on that right now, so it's not you.
that stuff never worked with me very much. I like the old-fashioned drugs.
Well, it works for me. It works for me. I mean, I knew what I was facing when this, like, the round geared up again.
It was like
again.
Taking some bennies and boning up, right?
It was just, hey, look, this is going to drive me crazy and I'm going to leave my wife and everything if something doesn't happen.
Speaking of $1 million, I had a kid at the Cuckoo's Nest sue me because a bouncer broke his nose or something.
Boy.
So he sued me for $1 million, right?
Right. I don't blame him.
So he comes in and I see him. I go, get out of here. I threw him out. He goes,
oh, you had to come back after that?
Yeah, comes back
in. You're going to sue Jerry Roach for $1 million. You know what? Take your $1 million and go to some other club. No, or the lesbian bar down the street.
No, but he was a regular customer. He didn't want to give up the Cuckoo's Nest. So I see him and then
Shame on him.
Get rid of that guy. They throw him out. He didn't do anything. I said, what about my $5? Well, add it to the million. Well, then the lawyer found out we didn't have insurance. So it was like, hey, you got to give me some money here if you want to sue. So he dropped the lawsuit.
Yeah.
My $1 million loss.
Good for you for not having insurance.
Well, that's the way it works because lawyers aren't interested if there's no insurance.
No, you can't find an attorney if the club doesn't have insurance or any assets.
Yeah, you can win. I'll give you the club.
Yeah.
Come down and start running it. See how you like it.
Exactly. You can break my nose.
Okay, yeah. Our Orange County behind the orange curtain. You don't hear that too much anymore.
You know what? I used to, I grew up in Orange County, and so I was, of course, I was offended by that term behind the orange curtain, yeah. as if there's this thing going on as soon as you cross the Orange County line.
Right.
And I moved to Hollywood, and everyone say that kind of stuff, and I'm on the radio, you know, for years, and talking to directors and actors and comedians. They're all talking about, oh, Orange County, behind the Orange County line, there's all this, you know, like as if it's some white power movement or
right.
something.
Moving into Barry Goldwater. Of course, he had a place down here at the Big
Walter
Club.
Knott. I don't know. But...
John Wayne.
I'll tell you, John Wayne. Yeah. Artukovich, the Nazi war criminal from Surfside Colony down there. Yeah, these are all just anecdotal white power people. No, but when I moved back to Orange County in like 2006, after the Indy 103.1 show, or the station went off the air.
Yeah, why? That was so popular.
I'll tell you why. 2000, they fired me as the morning host.
Oh, big mistake.
Big mistake. I mean, creatively, that might have been a great mistake. I mean, a great thing to do. But, you know, they got a new program director, and he wants to bring in his cronies. And that's so much cronyism in the radio business. So the new guy wants to get his cronies in there. And so after 2.5 years, he decides they're going to fire Joe, the morning host. And then they kept me as did my weekly legal advice show. I kept that. But they fired me as the morning host. And then they don't tell my sponsors. And I was cleaning up on the sponsors. They don't tell LegalZoom. They don't tell AT&T. They don't tell 1-800-Flowers. They don't tell Carson Toyota. They don't tell all these people. They don't tell Aventi Hair Restoration Formula. They don't tell the iPod Mini. They don't tell all these people. And then, the economy's taking a dump at that time. So they fire me, and then they tell those people, hey, we're going to have a new morning host. Every one of them says, well, like one of them, LegalZoom says, well, we're not giving you any money if it's not Joe Escalante. And they were loyal to me, and they're still with me. But the rest of them basically just said, okay. You know, we were going to cut back anyway, so now's a great time to cut back. And they're like, well, you're not going to sponsor our new interim host until we find a regular host? So the morning show represents most of the money from any radio station. So
morning drive, right?
Yeah. So they lost all the money overnight.
Hmm.
So about 6 weeks later, the station goes off the air and turns into a ranchero Mexican thing, which my wife, who's, you know, my wife is Colombian Mexican and listens to nothing but Latin music. And I ask her, I go, what kind of music is this? She goes... listens to him. She goes, that's music for poor people. It's not just for Mexicans. It's for poor Mexicans. So that is like...
what about the corridos?
The bad thing is I listen to that station now because I am a poor Mexican because I do not have a morning show anymore. But I'm grateful that they actually, you know, as part of the transitional thing, that they made music for me. But I moved back to Orange County, and then... I start hanging out at Orange County bars, and man, it takes about 10 minutes before you hear the most racist stuff you've ever heard in your life. Stuff that you just do not hear on the other side. Right. So I'm coming all the way around for full circle and saying all those Orange Curtain people, hey, you're kind of right.
So what about bullfighting? You want to admit to that?
Oh, bullfighting? Yeah, I'll admit to bullfighting. That's kind of how you and I reunited.
Yeah.
Because I was going to that bullfight school. It still exists, bullfightschool.com, Academy of Terramachia. But it's bullfightschool.com is a website.
Is it?
It's a website. Okay. There's a picture of me on there still.
And, yeah, that's a good shot, by the way.
Thank you.
Got your little outfit on.
Yeah. I mean, at some point, when I started making money, I started going, well, I have to waste some of this money, foolishly, obviously, and do something crazy. But my parents raised me as a bullfight fan, and living here, we're about an hour and a half from the border.
Yeah, it was great in those days,
yeah,
too.
You get there fast, you get back fast.
You know what ruined it? They outlawed advertising bullfighting.
Yeah, there's a California statute that
can't promote bullfighting.
Makes it a crime to promote a bullfight. So now it's just
they busted Coleman for that, for promoting bullfighting because he was head of school. That's how I met him. I read about it in the LA Times.
Okay. When you say Coleman, you mean the headmaster of the bullfight school?
Yeah. The academy. Yeah.
So I went there and did went through that whole program. I've killed 7 bulls in various rings in Mexico. And then I got the morning show, and I never killed anymore because you really have to be in shape. I mean, you know, it's pretty demanding. So I was waking up at like 4:30 in the morning and then sleeping the rest of the day when I got off work. So I never killed anymore after that, but I still go.
But
yeah, so bullfight, yeah, I do it. Most people hate it. You know that.
Yeah.
I'm a fan. I grew up with it. If you don't like bullfighting, I can't, you know, if you're a racist, you know, I can't help it.
Pretty funny.
Well, this, as you know, this year I went to Spain for a month and we got an apartment in Seville and we stayed there. We went to a lot of bullfights. And so I didn't post a lot of them on my Facebook because I know people don't like them that much.
Yeah,
bloody ones. I posted pictures of Matador. The guy looks handsome. I put it up there, that kind of stuff.
Kenneth Tynan, he wrote a book called Bull Fever, which is kind of an intellectual look at it. You know, he's a drama critic in London, famous drama critic, and he wrote this book, Bull Fever. But he says, never apologize, never explain.
Yeah. Strong. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because you can't anyway. It's a waste of time.
Yeah, it's a waste of time to explain everything to them. And to them, it's low-hanging fruit. It's the least intelligent animal rights people are the ones complaining about bullfighting.
Yeah, it's an easy target.
You know what? If you want to complain about animal cruelty, take on the fishing industry. And once you get the fishing industry done, those people that take fish and put hicks in their mouth and put them on a deck and make them flop around and suffocate, when you stop that, then come after me and we'll talk.
Well, fish don't count because they're cold-blooded or whatever.
Whatever. Who knows?
Yeah. So animal's an animal. What's the difference between an ant and a bull? But I guess it's the way you look at things. But
yeah, but it's not worth explaining it to him. So I don't.
But anyway, I love it, and I still do. And I from the very first time, they had me right from the beginning. But then there's times when I go away from it and come back. And now it's sort of like I'll go to a bunch of bullfights and start getting tired of that, and then I don't want to do it. And then I get tired of that and go back to watching them again. Gee, Joe, we're running out of time. It's I just interview people at. That I like or I'm friends with, and I haven't interviewed any strangers yet, so I don't have to do any homework. Just sit and start talking. But I guess someday I'll have to interview strangers. But
well, someday's you're of all the people you interview, I know there's a lot of interesting people, but you are one of the most interesting people in the world. So I hope you get enough of your stories in. I apologize for only talking about myself.
Well, no, it's all about you. I occasionally get one of mine in, but it's you know.
There should be a Jerry Roach day, and I'll come and interview you.
I get that sometimes in Spain when I had the beard, you know, and I had a sport coat on. They were the most interesting men alive.
Yeah, you could pull it off. You can pull it off.
I think I'm better looking than that guy.
I think that character might have been based on you, honestly. In fact, if we're going to sue people, we should sue those...
Bulls refuse to fight him.
Those beer people. Yeah, exactly. All right, Jerry.
Okay,
it's been awesome. What are we going out with?
How about I Have a Date?
I Have a Date.
By the Vandals. And thanks again, Joey.
This is a song that most young people think is a Vandals original, but it's really a cover. From the Simpletones, who I'm sure played at the Cuckoo's
them.
Nest.
They actually, oh, wow.
Yeah.
But so, they were happy.
You know what? They get back together and play every once in a while, and one of the guys told me it's all because the Vandals covered the song that they actually, and the guy lives in Germany, and he flies out here to do little reunion shows. And the singer, a couple singers, one of them was Snickers, he died a while ago, and... they still have their other singer. And if you see the Simpletones, make sure you go see them. And this is one of my all-time favorite songs. And I love playing the song live. And then when I'm playing the song, I go, this is fun. This is what it's all about, being fun, having fun in punk rock and playing a song like this.
Well, here it is. I Have a Date by the Vandals. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
I saw this girl and she drove me wild. She looked at me and I looked at her smile. The cutest girl you could ever see. I never dreamed that she'd go out with me. We met at school, so I asked her out. The only girl I ever thought about. She's 16 and she's so divine. I never thought that I could make her mine. I'm in love, I just can't wait. Tonight I have a date. I have a date.
He did his best to wake some pigs, Patrick.